December 2nd, 2015, Southern California was rocked by a terrorist attack. It was terrible. There was death. There was destruction. I remember being among the first reporters to show up in San Bernardino after we heard about this. It was what you might expect. There was sort of a controlled chaos, I guess, is one way to put it. A lot of not knowing what was going on and a lot of knowing that whatever was going on was terrible. And you can only imagine what the families were wondering, families of members who might have been at that luncheon where the terrorist attack occurred, not sure if their loved one was really there. That was certainly the case for the people you're about to meet. The people, the family that's joining us now for this podcast, rarely does interviews, and I'm grateful they're with us for this one. Hi there.
Hello.
Hello.
You know, it's a difficult subject to talk about, the things that you've gone through. Mm-hmm. Robert Velasco, his wife, I'm going to call you Mary.
Okay.
It's Maravel.
Yeah.
And Emily and Porteous is your last name?
Erica.
Erica, but Porteous.
Porteous, yeah.
See, I got the last name right. What did I call you?
Emily.
Emily. All right, you're now Emily. You can stay Erica. It's okay with me. So I want to ask you, just to take us back, let's start with Erica. Just take us back to that December in 2015 and take us through the story.
Okay, so I was actually on maternity leave when my sister was killed on December 2nd, the second largest terrorist attack since 9/11. To date, at that time. We saw on the news that there was a shooting at the Inland Regional Center in San Bernardino, and my sisters and I and my father had been communicating via text, and since I was not at work, my dad knew that I was okay, and he was kind of reaching out to find out where we all were. And we all responded except for Yvette. And we immediately started to panic, especially when we correlated her department being there and realized that she was there for sure. So we were kind of in a state of panic, and we rushed to be with my mother while my father and my husband hurried to the center where they were having all the family members go and be reunited with their family. So that night, that 24 hours was just horrible. We didn't sleep. And I think as the night drew closer to morning, we started to realize that my sister wasn't going to come home. And at some point, my father called me and my sisters upstairs to the master bedroom with our husbands, and we sat in a circle and we held hands, and my father asked God to give us the strength to face whatever it is that we needed to face. And at that point, I think we all realized that that Yvette was gone. And then we went to my father's house that morning, and we prepared for arrangements for the kids to be watched by my in-laws. And we waited there, and at, I'm not sure exactly what time, but at some point my father's captain, I believe, the CHP captain came knocking at the door, and none of us wanted to answer the door. We just called my father to go answer the door, and he gave my parents the news that Yvette was one of the 14 victims. And every moment since that day has been probably the hardest thing that my family and I have had to live through.
Even right now.
Yeah. Every moment is a challenge. The kids are what help us get through, but there's a lot of things that happen to a person physiologically, mentally, emotionally when something like this traumatic happens. I think a lot of people don't understand.
Is it that you're just one trigger word away from tears?
Yeah, but it the thing is that I think we've cried so much too, though. I never cried so much in my entire life. I've never felt that I've cried so much. You feel like all your tears have already, you're drained of tears. And I'm sure my mom could attest to what that feels like. But
I know that when my dad passed away quite a long time ago, through normal circumstances, the grieving process is such that you just suddenly, you could be at a stoplight, you're not listening to music, there's no trigger word or anything, boom, you start crying. And you boo-hoo, and you boo-hoo, and you go, why am I boo-hooing? It's just something about that grieving process. But in this case, this is not normal.
No, it's totally not normal. I think the thing that people don't really realize is that this is not death from a disease or even a freak accident, a car accident. It's not that. Somebody purposely murdered my sister in a fashion that is really like warfare. And so that's the traumatic part. I've done research to try to understand what we're going through. And there's a kind of like an indirect post-traumatic stress that happens. And there's trauma that happens.
Why is that called an indirect post-traumatic?
Because we were not there in the room, but we live it through her.
Every day.
Yeah. I mean, also because of the, you know, wrapping our minds around what happened to her and what she must have experienced in those last moments and just everything. It's traumatic, and there is actually something that happens neurologically in a person's brain that has to kind of we've kind of had to like relearn how to live. It's like removing a limb from your body and trying to adjust to this new part of yourself, because in reality, my sister was a part of me. And she always will be. And so it's just been really devastating. The last few years has been very difficult for all of us.
Picking up on that, Marvell, mm-hmm. When we talk about wondering what that was like at the end, you probably lived that over and over and over again.
Oh, yeah, all the time. And it's really weird, too, how your mind protects you from your thoughts, because a lot of times I try to think of what it must have been like for her, you know, those last few minutes. For some reason, my mind does not let me go there. It's almost, you know, I shared this with my other daughter, and she says, Mom, you can't, because you'll probably die if you go there. So it's a part of your brain that's protecting you not to go there.
I got to tell you, I mean, if something happened to one of my kids, just normally, let alone abnormally, I'd be devastated. If something like the traumatic experience that your daughter, your sister went through, I can't even imagine how I would respond to that. Because children mean so much to us.
Oh, of course.
And Yvette, tell me about Yvette, Robert.
Like my daughter Erica said, you know, Yvette was a big part of our family. We're a very close family, close-knit. So
religious family?
Yeah, sort of. You know, Yvette, you know, we're a Catholic family, and Yvette, she kind of rebelled as she got older and wasn't sure what she wanted to be, but we accepted that. You know, she's an adult now. You know, she kind of.
Isn't that something when they turn 18, all of a sudden they're an adult now?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, we had a lot of, you know, because we were a big family, have four daughters and six grandchildren. So we spend a lot of, you know, celebrations, you know, birthday celebrations, you know, holiday celebrations together. And Yvette was always a big part of it. You know, she would always experimented with us, you know, cooking different things, you know, and, kind of introduced us to different types of dishes and stuff. And so at the time, you know, I kind of, you know, would, you know, poke fun at her and, you know, like, what are you serving us to eat this time, you know? And
she had a great sense of humor.
Exactly, yes. And so she's always, you know, getting us to eat different things. And so those are things that we miss, you know.
Was she bigger than life in her personality? Some people are introvertive. Some people are extrovertive.
She was like I said, she, and during our...
Still having some tears there, aren't you?
Well, yeah. And I'm actually a little bit, I have a head cold, but she was introverted in the sense that she was a private person, but when she was close to us, so we knew her, and she was very passionate about certain topics. She was very loving. She liked to explore, you know, different dishes and other cultures. Right, Mom?
Yeah.
And she was successful. She was getting her license to be a health inspector. Is that right?
Yes. She had just been certified by the state. It's a pretty difficult process, you know. She did have, you know, her degree, her bachelor's of science degree in environmental health. But you still have to be certified by the state. And so she went through this process of, you know, studying and then taking the test to be licensed. And she had just accomplished that just a couple of months before. And then that day just happened to be the day that she was going to be presented with her badge.
At that Christmas lunch.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. With her colleagues.
Yes. So I don't know if she ever got a chance to see it or they didn't present it to her. That badge was presented to her mother and I by the County Board of Supervisors a few days later. We got contacted by, it might have been like a week later or so, mm-hmm. We got contacted by the FBI and said that the supervisors had this badge that they wanted to give us.
I want to ask you, and I appreciate your candor, and I appreciate your letting me ask some difficult questions. This was a terrorist attack. This wasn't just somebody going into a workplace or somebody going into a business and, you know, going what they call postal, right? This was somebody who had an agenda, two people that had an agenda. And when 9/11 happened, I'm sure none of us ever think that that kind of thing can roost itself back on our own homes and families.
No. Yeah, we remember, well, just a few months earlier, we had... the Paris attack, you know, had happened, and we couldn't, I mean, we were watching that, and we were thinking, wow, that I can't even imagine going through something like that. And then we were, at the same time, we were talking about it, and we thought, oh, that'll never happen in San Bernardino.
That's exactly what we thought.
Where we're at, you know, if something like that happens,
we're safe.
It'll probably happen, you know, Disneyland or
Los Angeles,
downtown LA or something. Never imagined that it would happen in our backyard.
I've got to agree with you on that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the day I was working, and when I got the word to get to San Bernardino yesterday, I mean, get there ASAP because there was an apparent mass shooting. The word had gone out that there could be 20 plus that were hit. That usually is an indication of big-time trouble. And we got over there, and I remember what that was like. I remember the scene. I remember the people like you that were so incredibly anxious because you were trying to find out information. Now, you, Robert, actually went hospital to hospital once you got a little nervous and thought, hey, my daughter might have been one of them.
Yes. What happened, I was at a recreation center where they gathered the families that were looking for loved ones. It was a gymnasium, and the gymnasium.
What was it like in there, by the way?
It was terrible. I mean, just looking at everybody's faces because they didn't. It was the unknown. You know, they didn't know where their family members were or what had happened to them or if they were one of the victims, and so. This gymnasium was full of people, you know, when I first got there, and there was, you know, a lot of cameras outside and different TV stations and everything. And as the day wore on, you know, the crowd started thinning out, and there was only several families left, and I was one of the last ones, and we were one by one, you know, these last families that were left. This is into the night. they were bringing us into this separate room where someone from the sheriff's coroner's, you know, department was talking to them and kind of trying to prepare people for the worst, you know, pretty much. And but when it when my heart sank was when a friend of mine, colleague, he's a CHP captain from the Baldwin Park area. But you know, we kind of grew up together in the department, you know, with our careers. And he showed up at the gym. You know, he's in uniform, shows up, and was there for support. A couple other officers showed up and asked if there was anything I needed. I kept telling him, I just want my daughter, you know, help me find my daughter. And then when they took me to this next room where we spoke to somebody from the sheriff's department, again, they weren't asserting anything, you know, that anything had happened to my daughter. They were, I guess I was... didn't want to accept that something had happened to her. You know, I was trying to hang on to any sliver of hope. And she, and they explained that, you know, this was not telling us that my daughter was gone or anything, but that they wanted to prepare me, you know, for the worst.
You were a CHP lieutenant.
Yes.
You're retired now. You had dealt with situations where there was the worst case scenario. Yes. Did you ever have to tell a family that they had lost their loved one?
Yes, a couple of times. It's usually something that we leave up to the coroner's office. You know, of course, we would accompany them to people's homes, you know, to give them the bad news. But I had to do it on a couple of occasions. But, you know, my whole career with the Ohio Patrol, nothing could have prepared me for this. You know, this was the worst.
Maravel?
Yeah.
The tears.
Every time we share, you know, it's like reliving it all over again. It's just
talk to me
horrible.
About that. Tell me about that.
Robert, like he said, he was gone. And I kept texting him, you know, have you found her? Have you found her? And he'd say, not yet, not yet. You know, they're bringing in more buses, you know, of people. And then it was already 9 o'clock at night when he showed up at the door. And my son-in-laws were with him. Some of his colleagues were with him. And when I saw them walk in the door, one by one, I expected to see Yvette among them. And then when they all walked in the door and she wasn't with them, my heart just sunk. And he came to me, you know, my husband came to me and said, there's still hope, there's still hope. And he cried, and I cried, because even though he said there's still hope, we knew she was gone. And we were just waiting for confirmation, you know, by phone, but it didn't come. And we just waited into the night and made everybody comfortable in different spots of the house. And we slept. Tried to sleep because we really didn't sleep. Everybody was just kind of crying by themselves. And till we woke up to the morning, and because we were at my daughter's house where I was watching her children, so we finally decided to go home. We only lived a few minutes away, so we went home and showered. And then, like Erica said, eventually the knock on the door came, and we got confirmation that yes, she was gone.
And Robert, because you had knocked on people's doors, you knew what that knock meant.
Yes, I knew. As soon as I saw, you know, my captain, who's a good friend of mine as well, and a couple of my good friends were with them as well, as soon as I saw him, I knew. I knew what had happened.
Erica, you speak eloquently of your sister. Tell everybody a little bit about her.
She was my soulmate.
It's okay. Take a breath.
She was a phenomenal aunt to my children. She was a career woman. She was smart. He was beautiful outside and inside. She was disappointed in the world and injustices, and she wanted to instill in the children that education was important, and that treating people kindly was important, and that to not be closed off to narrow-mindedness. She was very open to learning about other people's cultures and perspectives. And I think that's why when my father said, you know, she would say, well, she's not really sure about, you know, Catholicism. She didn't want to place herself in any one box. And
she was an independent thinker.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And she was very wise beyond her years. My sisters and I were older than her, but we always went to her for advice or guidance, because we knew that her direction was usually sound, because she always had, you know, our best interests at heart. And she had a good head on her shoulders. And I think what's the most painful is not, you know, making memories and having to watch the kids grow and not have her there seeing that. But make no doubt about it, the kids, all of them, no matter, you know, how many years go by, they all still reference her. We still incorporate her into our lives. So I think she continues to live on in us and in what we're doing, and, you know, trying to make an impact on in any way we can, in a positive way. She was just a wonderful human being.
That's exactly what she sounds like to me. From everything that you've told me, and well, all of you have told me, and the other thing that's come out of all of this is a sense of concern over the weapon that killed her.
Yeah, that's a big concern to us from that point on. I mean, I had concerns in the past, you know, working in law enforcement. You know, I often thought about our officers that are out in the field, that that they may someday face someone with a weapon of that type. We have them in our department, you know, or we had them in our department for
semi-automatic weapons.
Semi-automatic, you know, rifles to be able to defend the public.
And so what is your feeling about this? Now, we to be fair here and balanced here, the NRA takes a position that, you know, they shouldn't be banned because it's a slippery slope on the constitutional Second Amendment. Mm-hmm. And when you start doing one thing and taking it away, then there's possibly the next thing and possibly the next thing. And so what is your reaction to that, Robert?
I don't agree with them. You know, I think, you know, I'm a person that wants the Second Amendment. You know, I believe in the Second Amendment. Yeah, you
should it be changed in any way?
Well, not the Second Amendment itself, but the types of weapons that are that people, the general public, has access to. I think in this day and age in society, a semi-automatic rifle is not necessary. You know, it's unreasonable to have that type of weapon out there. It's not a reasonable type of weapon to have.
I think Erica earlier told me it was laughable to hear other people defend an automatic weapon. Is that right?
That's correct, because so the Second Amendment, the intention of the Second Amendment is to bear arms through a well-regulated militia. So the form of weapons that should be used or should be accessible to the general public should not be the you know, AR-15 that could destroy multiple people, massive amount of people, in a very short amount of time.
Like That's Las Vegas.
Its intention, the intention of those types of weapons are for war and for law enforcement use. And so when law enforcement is outgunned and they are the ones that are charged with protecting and serving our community, then there's a problem. And so I think the what people need to really realize is that the Second Amendment is being taken out of context, and it's not being looked at it for what it was intended.
It was intended, though, to give you a way to protect yourself.
Correct.
Sure.
One of the things they talk about is, you know, one of the things I've heard was, well, you want this because if you live alone or if you have a daughter or if there's some reason to feel that you're not in a position to protect yourself, these weapons can protect you. And your reaction to that is?
Yeah, it's not reasonably necessary to have an AR-15. Too much firepower. If someone tells you that they need it to protect their family and their home, that is not what you need. You know, this weapon is designed for war, and it can shoot hundreds of rounds of in a minute. You know, if it's modified to be a fully automatic weapon.
So what should happen? I mean, you know, I understand both sides and the positions on all sides. I do get that. In California, I think with semi-automatic weapons, there are laws on how much you can have in a magazine. What is that, 10?
10
bullets in a magazine?
Yeah, no more than 10.
And I guess in the Las Vegas situation, some of those magazine rounds were much more. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, much more. And that's the problem in our country. You know, California can have, I mean, it has some of the most restrictive gun laws. But you go to other states, you know, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, and they have different laws, you know, so some of those weapons are either bought online or however and brought back to California.
So let me ask you this. I mean, we know that the NRA is very powerful. They lobby our lawmakers. The lawmakers have to make laws that would, as you would have it, make a
sure.
change. Do you feel like sometimes in putting this message out there that you're up against sort of a tidal wave?
Yes, but I think the tidal wave, I think, is starting to slow down and go the other way, you know, because, you know, thanks to the kids in Parkland, you know, Florida, they're turning the ship the other way, you know, to get some of these politicians, you know, at the federal level and state level to take a look at these gun laws. You know, they're making them pay attention, you know, stand up and pay attention. So we're happy to see that.
You know, Robert, I remember you went up to Sacramento, and you spoke to the CalPERS board about investment and the concern you had with the system that provides health care for employees in the state of California. You didn't want them to take money in pensions and invest it into people, companies that make guns or ammunition or that sort of thing. What kind of reaction did you get to your message?
I think we got sympathetic, or they listened to us, and you know, some of the board members were actually in tears. However, you know, a couple of members expressed that they felt that they would have a more of an influence if they stayed invested in these companies, because they would have a seat at the table to put pressure on them to either stop selling these weapons or make changes to, you know, to their policies as far as producing them or selling them. So, but what we were looking for was a full divestment from these companies, you know, and what it is, you know, CalPERS is the, you know, a pension fund, and I'm a CalPERS member, and I understand that they have to have, you know, make sensible and investments, you know, to make money for the fund, but there are other, you know, options to invest to keep, you know, that they're still.
And that was what you were trying to tell them.
That's what we were trying to tell them, yes.
Is that an ongoing effort?
Yes.
Or was it a one-shot?
No, it's an ongoing effort. This was a one, you know, the first of you know, of the shots that we were taking at it. And we were there in support for the, you know, state treasurer, who is a CalPERS board member as well.
Right.
And we were there to support his, you know, his proposal.
I guess that, you know, I want to sort of wrap this up thinking about it, that. But I can't get past the notion that this was a terrorist attack. Just like 9/11, where airplanes went into buildings, these were two people that were armed to the teeth. They came into the building with the intent of killing people. in the name of jihad. And when you think about that, it's one thing to get killed in a bank robbery. It's one thing to get killed in a drive-by shooting. But a terrorist attack is something that is of an enormous magnitude. Erica?
It is. It's been terrorizing to our family, but it has made us see more clearly what changes need to be made.
And you're going to work on that.
Oh, yes. Yes.
You're going to dedicate your life to that?
Of course.
Yeah.
You know, starting with how I raise my children and what perspectives they are open to and what they're taught and, you know, about tolerance and understanding that differences do not mean inferiority. And I think we have a long way to go. And I think that we're, you know, trying to address different issues. But right now is the issue of the, you know, assault weapons. But, you know, we're just trying to live each day, you know, to the best of our ability. And we're not going to stop, you know, trying to make a difference.
Let's end on a thought about Yvette. Want to share one?
Sure. You want to help me, Mom?
A thought about Yvette.
Okay, so she would have, you know, sometimes when I saw the children, the kids of Parkland, they kind of reminded me of how she was. She was the type of person that was quiet and private, but she could not stay quiet if she saw injustice or wrongdoing. She had to speak her mind and speak her truth. And so I kind of want to, you know, just say that I'm very proud of the next generation, and they give our family and the future hope. And sometimes I kind of see, you know, Yvette in them. And so...
Mom?
Yes, I'm so thankful to them. When that shooting happened...
In Parkland,
I was just so... Again, so
every one of these things hits you personally,
yes.
Doesn't it?
Yes, every time it happens, it's like we relive it again and again. And when I saw that they were going to fight, and you know, against these weapons, and I saw how strongly they were, you know, speaking and fearlessly, you know.
Did that give you courage to speak up?
Oh my gosh! Yes.
Because most people don't know, but this is really the first extended interview that you're doing.
Right.
Because you really haven't wanted to be interviewed.
It was like I wanted to cheer and say, yes, yes, somebody's saying something. You know,
so those kids encouraged you to do things like come talk to me.
Yes. And, you know, I'm so thankful to them because I finally saw light at the end of the tunnel. I finally saw, like, something is going to be done. I finally had hope. And so, of course, you know, I said, you know, let's do something. I run to my husband and the girls, and you know, I said, we have to help them. We have to do whatever we need to do because, you know, they're opening the doors for everybody, and you know, this is the time, and we've got to speak. And so that's why we're here.
Robert.
Yeah, I agree with my wife. You know, someone asked me. Do you think these kids in, you know, from Parkland, are they having, do you think they'll have an impact? You know, they're asking me if they are, do you think they're going to have an impact? I said, they already have, you know, they've already made an impact. They've already got the state government in Florida to change some of the laws, and it's one of the most, conservative, you know, governments there in the state of Florida, and they got them to change, and they're getting the politicians in Washington, D.C. to listen and getting other people, you know, excited about change and to, you know, go with this movement of getting those changes that we need to have in our gun laws.
From everything I've seen and heard, Yvette was a lovely lady.
She was.
She was. She was.
She's beautiful.
She was our baby, but yes, she was a lovely lady. She's still our baby.
Thank you all for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Hal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I really appreciate this family coming on. As well, you can imagine just how difficult it is for them to talk publicly. And this really was the first time they've sat in on a podcast and had a conversation like this. And I'm grateful they did that with me. This is probably a good time, if you haven't done it yet, to subscribe to What the Hal and listen to the thoughtful things that we're doing, the humorous things that we're doing, the things that, have to do with our lives and our everyday existence, and what the hell, you know? We'll see you next time.